Today's Wednesday, April 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, countries that import oil from Iran slam the U.S. over sanctions.
Any nation or entity interacting with Iran should do its diligence and err on the side of caution. The risks are simply not going to be worth the benefits.
Democrats are divided about impeaching President Trump. Also ahead, singer Sheryl Crow is about to release what she says will be her last album. This one will have a strong political message. It's all on today's International Edition. Oil prices reached a six-month high Tuesday after the Trump administration announced it would no longer exempt countries from U.S. sanctions if they continue to buy Iranian crude oil, a move aimed at imposing a complete oil embargo on Iran. Waivers granted to eight countries include big Iranian crude importers like China, India, Japan, Turkey, and South Korea are due to expire on May 2nd. Trump's decision to end waiver sanctions threatens to further escalate tensions with a number of countries. They face or could face U.S. sanctions, which were reinstated after Trump withdrew from the 2015 nuclear deal between Iran and the six world powers. Joining us to talk more about it is Benham Bentaleblou of the Washington-based Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. What do you think of all this?
Well, I think the ultimate reasoning was part of the reasoning for the general max pressure campaign. This is simply dialing it up a bit. The ultimate reasoning is you generate pressure, you put pain on Iran's economy, and you force the clerical regime to come back to the negotiating table, but this time not to ink a nuclear-only deal, but to ink a broader, more comprehensive agreement. And to get that more comprehensive agreement, there is going to have to be more pressure, and the regime itself is going to have to be put to a choice. And going after the lifeblood of their economy, oil really is one way. It's why the oil sanctions have been on the books in the U.S. really since 2011, but restricting those who invest in Iran's energy sector has been part and parcel of congressional statutes since the 90s.
Explain to me how the U.S. has the ability to control other nations' imports of oil.
Well, it's through a creative dangling of the market dynamics, risk dynamics, as well as the broader political system that the U.S. has basically set up in the post-war period. We know that oil itself is a global commodity. The U.S. doesn't use Iranian oil, obviously, here, but it has the ability to use market dynamics against countries that would use or would import Iranian oil, and to put those countries, in turn, to a choice, and to say it's either the threat of U.S. sanctions have gone quite far over the past decade on a bipartisan basis, or siding with Iran and providing the regime with money, this lifeblood for their economy, for them to conduct some of their malign activities like terrorism, missile tests, whatnot. So in this regard, the U.S., again, kind of uses this creative formula of market dynamics, the broader political system it created, and creative diplomacy to put these countries to the choice. And much like you saw a bunch of European and Asian banks and business shudder after May 8th from Tehran and side with Washington, even though politicians in those capitals sided with Iran, market dynamics, again, can do something similar.
Do you see this being successful? We have seen oil prices start to surge higher now because of this.
Well, oil prices have gone up a bit. Brent went up, I think, a few dollars in the past 48 hours, really, since the announcement. And I would expect that to continue in the very, very short term. Again, some markets are going to be spooked by this. But you look at what the U.S. has done on the oil side since the U.S. withdrew from the nuclear deal. It targeted the financing. One of the sanctions that the U.S. restored that really came into place under the Obama administration was the targeting of Iran's oil sales in foreign bank accounts. So the waivers, which the Trump administration is now terminating as of May 8th, permitted select countries to buy reduced amounts of Iranian oil, then have those countries open up bank accounts in their own countries denominated in local currency to prevent Iran from repatriating that currency and force Iran to buy humanitarian goods in those countries and then import those goods back. So for the past year, the Trump administration has targeted the financing side. Now it looks like it's stepping up the pressure and targeting this export of the commodity itself. And this is really the way you squeeze Iran from both ends. Everything since May 8th is high risk, high reward. Mm-hmm. But the point is to use those dynamics of risk against Iran and to make the regime blink first. And obviously, given the massive political and economic disparity between these two nations, the goal is to drive them to the table and not have the U.S. appear eager for a deal. This is where the administration is taking an existing penalty and dialing it up to 11 to make sure that the countries that import Iranian oil are also put to a choice. The big problem I have right now is not with Iran after May 2nd, but with the major Asian hydrocarbon economies, countries countries like China and India, which are very reliant on Iranian oil. And if you look at their import numbers, they're almost back to pre-2011 levels, which is quite terrifying if you're interested in restricting Iran's oil exports. So the question is, if these two countries don't reduce in time, will the U.S. actually make good on its threat? That right now remains an open question.
The timing is interesting here with all this happening, with a couple pretty significant dates on the horizon.
That's right. While May 2nd, of course, is the day the waivers lapse, and technically on May 3rd, the U.S. would be terminating all of these provisions and putting those importers of Iranian oil to the choice. May 8th is the one-year anniversary of when the U.S. walked out of the JCPOA nuclear deal. And if you look at some of the more recent moves, the May 8th deadline does dangle over them, issuing this massive reward for Hezbollah financiers and Hezbollah members, the increased pace of Treasury Department designation, the recent addition on April 15th of the IRGC, which is a part of Iran's formal military apparatus, to the Foreign Terrorist Organization list, a historic first, ending an 11-year debate in Washington of is the IRGC a terrorist organization. All of this prior to reaching May 8th. So I think the administration is going to have some interesting statistics here if it wants to marshal what has it done in the 1 year since it left the deal. The question is, after that 1 year anniversary mark, what must it do to get Iran to the table? Because I don't think Iran will come to the table in the next 3 weeks.
That's Ben Talablu of the Washington-based Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Sri Lanka attackers may have been linked to ISIS, which claimed responsibility. Scaremongering video is undermining anti-polio drive in Pakistan. The UN adopts a weak resolution on sexual violence in conflict. And Zimbabwe Wildlife Orphanage is rescuing animals and educating against poaching. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com. And on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The Supreme Court's conservative majority seemed ready Tuesday to uphold the Trump administration's plan to ask about citizenship on the 2020 census, despite evidence that millions of Hispanics and immigrants could go uncounted. Associated Press reporter Mark Sherman explains.
It's a question that the Trump administration wants to add, and that various states and cities and immigrant rights and other groups oppose. And the reason that this is important is because the results of the census will help determine the allocation of seats in the House of Representatives among the states, as well as the allocation of billions of dollars in federal money over the next 10 years.
And he says there seemed to be a clear divide between the court's liberal and conservative justices in arguments in a case that could affect how many seats states have in the House of Representatives and their share of federal dollars over the next 10 years.
The five conservative justices on the court did not seem particularly troubled by some of the claims made by the challengers. And those claims were also backed up by three federal judges who have ruled that the administration can't add the question to the 2020 census. Three of those judges found that the question was illegal under federal law, and two of them also found that it would violate the Constitution's provision that calls for a census every 10 years to count the entire U.S. population, not, of course, just citizens.
Well, three lower courts have so far blocked the plan to ask every U.S. citizen about citizenship in this, or U.S. resident about citizenship in the census, finding that the question would discourage many immigrants from being counted. In the wake of last week's public release of a redacted version of the Mueller report, some opposition Democrats, including a few running for president, have stepped up calls for the impeachment of President Donald Trump. Overall, though, Democrats appear split over whether to pursue the lengthy and politically divisive course of trying to impeach the president and remove him from office. We have more now from VOA national correspondent Jim Malone.
Campaigning in the states of New Hampshire and Massachusetts, Senator and Democratic presidential candidate Elizabeth Warren is leading the charge for President Trump's impeachment.
We cannot be an American that says it is okay for a president of the United States to try to block investigations into a foreign attack on our country or investigations into that president's own misbehavior.
Fellow presidential contender and South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg is more noncommittal.
I think that Congress needs to make that decision. I think he may well deserve it. But my focus, since I'm not part of Congress, but I am part of 2020, is to give him a decisive defeat at the ballot box.
For the moment, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi opposes impeachment, preferring to hold the president and his administration accountable through congressional oversight hearings. Analyst Julie Pace.
She feels like in order to move forward on impeachment, you have to not only have really solid evidence of an impeachable offense, but you also have to be able to bring not just Democrats, but also Republicans on board.
Many Democrats remain conflicted, says California Representative Adam Schiff.
Is that the best thing for the country to take up an impeachment proceeding? Because to do otherwise sends a message that this conduct is somehow compatible with office. Or is it in the best interest of the country not to take up an impeachment that we know will not be successful in the Senate because the Republican leadership will not do its duty?
Even Democrats who support impeachment concede that it is a lengthy and politically risky process, says analyst Matt Dalek.
By the time impeachment proceedings were even to ramp up, you're talking about the end maybe of 2019 or early 2020, that creates its own complication because there's another remedy for removing a president, and it's called the election.
President Trump blasted Democrats on Twitter and told reporters he's not even a little bit worried about impeachment. It's all part of the political battle to come, says expert John Fortier.
Well, I don't think it's over. We'll keep talking about it. But I think the top line was what the president wanted to hear. It was that there was no collusion between the Trump campaign and Trump himself and the Russian government.
Even if Democrats hold off on impeachment, the Mueller report is likely to get plenty of attention from Democratic presidential contenders all through the 2020 election cycle. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
U.S. President Donald Trump met Tuesday with the top executive from Twitter. Trump said he had a great meeting with CEO Jack Dorsey hours after bashing the company and accusing it of not treating him well because he's a Republican. Trump uses Twitter extensively to get his message out, particularly since the release of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report, including more than 40 tweets and retweets in the last 2 days, and two, criticizing Twitter itself. VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman has the story.
Twitter Chief Executive Officer Jack Dorsey met with Trump in the Oval Office. Their discussion occurred just hours after the president on the popular social media platform complained Twitter treats him unfairly. Trump, who has nearly 60 million Twitter followers, said he would have a lot more, except for what he claims are deliberate efforts by the company to thwart a larger online fan base. Trump later tweeted it was a great meeting about Twitter and social media in general, and he looks forward to keeping an open dialogue. Steve Herman, VOA News, at the White House.
Well, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is expected to travel this week to the far eastern Russian city of Vladivostok for a summit with Russian President Vladimir Putin. As VOA's William Gallo reports from Seoul, Kim is expected to push Putin for sanctions relief amid stalled nuclear talks with the United States.
Over the past year, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has held high-profile summits with not only U.S. President Donald Trump, but also the leaders of Vietnam, China, and South Korea. Until now, he hadn't met Vladimir Putin. But this week, the far eastern Russian city of Vladivostok is set to host the first-ever meeting between the two men. The latest evidence Kim has emerged from his international isolation.
What this has mainly done is give Kim some international credibility. He was a pariah a year ago, and now suddenly he's everybody's prom date. You know, everyone wants to be seen with him on their arm.
Kim wants relief from painful UN sanctions that remain in place after nuclear talks with the United States broke down. Putin may not provide much help. With his own economy hurting, North Korea is not seen as a top priority. But the summit could help reduce North Korea's reliance on China, its biggest trading partner.
I think he's just trying to cover all his options. You know, North Korea historically has survived by playing Russia against China and playing everyone against everyone else.
Residents in the port city of Vladivostok are excited to host the meeting.
I believe they will come to some agreement. It is pretty scary when you hear all the time about nuclear testing, because Vladivostok is just a couple hundred kilometers away from North Korea's testing sites.
But it's not clear how the meeting will help break the deadlock between Kim and Trump. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
The UN Security Council held an open debate on the effects of sexual violence in conflict on Tuesday. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres told the council that sexual violence is deliberately used as a tactic of war to terrorize people, to demonize communities, and to destabilize society so that they struggle to recover for years or even decades. He also noted the importance of women-led organizations.
Where women are part of peacekeeping missions, we know that reporting and protection from sexual violence increases. When women are at the peace table, there is greater likelihood of accountability for these crimes. When women are part of ceasefire monitoring, they can ensure that gender-based crimes are monitored and reported.
Human rights lawyer and activist Amal Clooney and Nobel Peace Prize laureate Nadia Murad and Denis Mukwege Mukwege were among the guests in New York on Tuesday. Clooney demanded justice for victims of sexual violence in conflicts, especially rapes and abuses by Islamic State extremists in Iraq and Syria.
Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, this is your Nuremberg moment. Your chance to stand on the right side of history. You owe it to Nadia and to the thousands of women and girls who must watch ISIS members shave off their beards and go back to their normal lives while they, the victims, never can.
A vote on a draft resolution was constructed in spite of strong opposition from permanent members, China, Russia, and the U.S. 90 member states participated. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
On Our Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about, sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower, and change the rules. It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka. Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, Americans love their pets so much that, according to a survey by the American Pet Products Association, U.S. pet owners spend about $70 billion a year on pet products. And it's been a big debate about which is more popular, dogs or cats. Dogs seem to always win every year, hands down. But now a Washington, D.C. animal rescue organization is making sure there is equal time for cats. D.C.'s Humane Rescue Alliance is hosting the first annual Meow D.C. this weekend, a cat-focused event for everyone, but especially cat lovers. Joining us to talk about it is Humane Rescue Alliance Director of Special Events, Emily Miller. Emily, tell us about Meow D.C.
We are launching D.C.'s first all-cat-themed event, Meow D.C., on April 27th, and we are super excited about it.
What happens at this event?
What people should expect?
Yes, what should people expect?
I would say there's going to be 50-plus vendor booths that will be offering everything from cat accessories to accessories for you to cat treats, cat toys, paintings, artwork, food items. We're going to have activities. You can make your own cat ear headbands. We're going to show you how to make outdoor cat shelters. There's face painting and nail art. And then to top it all off, we're obviously going to have a huge cat adoption event to accompany the event all day long.
Any kitty celebrities going to be there?
There will be. So we are excited to welcome Sunglass Cat of Instagram fame. And Sunglass Cat's name is actually Bagel, and she will be there doing a meet and greet for most of the day.
Why is she famous? Where do we know her from?
Really, I think it's just the year of the Instagram cat. Some of these cats just become famous for crazy reasons, but Instagram has a bunch of eye issues, and so she wears sunglasses out of necessity and just became famous from posting pictures on social media. Now she goes out and helps charity organizations raise money.
So she is a full-on celebrity kitty cat.
That's right.
Very cool. How many people are you expecting to show up?
We are expecting 1,000 people this first year, and we're very excited about it.
Do you think this will become an annual event?
We certainly hope so. As you mentioned before, dogs get a bunch of events because it's easy to take your dog out, but this will be the one event targeted to cats and cat people alike, so we hope it'll stick around for a while.
What do you think it is about animals and pets, in particular domesticated animals like dogs and cats, that Americans are willing to spend so much money on, so much time and energy, and just literally treat them as if they were children?
You just tapped onto it. Some people aren't having children anymore, and so their pets are their children, and they treat them like a member of their family, and they're willing to go to all lengths to make sure they have the best clothes, the best accessories, the best food. Some pets, you would say, are taken care of better than some children. I have 4 cats myself, and I know they're spoiled rotten. So I think it's just a matter of our pets now are part of our family, and so we just want to treat them very well.
All right. That is Emily Miller, Director of Special Events at the Humane Rescue Alliance. Thanks for being with us. Well, Sheryl Crow has released a political and spiritual song about war featuring vocals from the late Johnny Cash that will be featured on what she says is her last full-length album. Crow's Redemption Day was originally included on her Grammy-winning 1996 self-titled album and later recorded by Cash and released after his death in 2003. Neither song was released as a single, but Crow would sometimes play her version alongside Cash's when she played live. Crow recorded a new version of the song, trading her guitar for a piano and adding his vocals for a haunting duet that was released Friday, along with a music video featuring archival footage of Cash. And during a visit to the Cash Cabin studio in Hendersonville, Tennessee, where Cash's vocals were recorded, Crow told the Associated Press that she wrote the song after visiting troops during the war in Bosnia.
I made a trip in 1995 to Bosnia with then First Lady Hillary Clinton. And I had never, I'd never been any place even remotely related to a war-torn area. And it was really eye-opening. Her objective was to speak with women and children. And I played for the troops. And we went to several different places and flew over this sort of demolished. I made a trip in 1995 to Bosnia with then First Lady Hillary Clinton, and I had never, I'd never been any place even remotely related to a war-torn area, and it was really eye-opening. Her objective was to speak with women and children, and I played for the troops, and we went to several different places and flew over this sort of demolished countryside, and when I got home, everything that was on TV was Rwanda. It wasn't really covering Bosnia, and Rwanda was going through a genocide, and all I could think was, what is the decision-making behind going into one country and not going into another country? And so the outcome of that was sitting down at my computer and writing a song, and really just writing the lyric top to bottom, almost like a Bob Dylan song, and then picking up a guitar, and that was it. I mean, I wrote the whole thing in probably 15 minutes, and that is very unusual for me, particularly a song that's politically oriented. Recorded the song, and then many years later, after June Carter passed, I sang at her funeral and visited with Johnny at length, and then his son-in-law called me and said, I've played this song Redemption Day for my father-in-law, and he wants to record it. And so it was just extremely not only humbling, but kind of shocking that he would want to go in this soon after June had passed and that he even wanted to record it all. And so he asked me a slew of questions on the telephone about what each lyric meant. And I could see in that moment that the reason we believed everything he ever sang was because he wouldn't sing it if he didn't believe it and really take it to heart. So he recorded the song and sent it to me and said, this is going to be the cornerstone of my record. And then a few weeks later, he passed. So cut to the making of this record, and we had gone out a couple of summers ago and had been doing Redemption Day and had been using his version in the video, and the audience was always just slayed by that. And so I thought, well, maybe I'll just rewrite the song for today's time, particularly with what's going on in our country and in the world. And that's how we wound up with this version of Redemption Day. And I hope wherever he is, I feel certain that's heaven.
The accompanying video features the two singers along with historical footage of war, genocide, and political and social movements. The song is from Crow's upcoming album for Valerie Music Company, which will also include duets with Keith Richards, Stevie Nicks, and Eagles members Don Henley and Joe Walsh, among others. Crow has said in the past that she'll stop making albums, and she reiterated that to the AP. She said while she loves albums, she'd rather release individual songs that are timelier and more immediate.
It's in the soul to feel such things, but weak to watch without speaking.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Heaven's gate, and on the way, child and man and woman wait, watch and wait for Redemption Day.
Fire rages in the streets and swallows everything it meets. It's just an image often seen on television. Come leaders, come ye men of great, let us hear you pontificate. Your many virtues laid to waste, and we aren't listening. There is a train that's heading straight to heaven's gate, to heaven's gate. And on the way, child and man and woman wait, watch and wait for Redemption Day.
What do you have for us today? Throw us a bone but save the blade. Oh, why you waited till so late?
Was there no oil to excavate? No riches in trade for the fate of every person who died in hate? Throw us a bone, ye men of great. There is a train that's heading straight to heaven's gate, to heaven's gate. And on the way, child and man and woman wait, watching wait for Redemption Day. It's buried in the countryside.
it's hidden in the shells of night.
It's everywhere a baby cries. Freedom.
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 Freedom. Freedom.